The Tom Woods Show, episode 1637.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you've ever considered publishing a book through Kindle, I have a lot of experience with it. I helped to publish Bob Murphy's book in Kindle, my own book, Real Descent, that was self-published, I published in Kindle, and I've assembled some videos that will show you step-by-step all the tech aspects of preparing your manuscript to be published as a Kindle book, and also a series of strategies that most people don't know about that Kindle itself makes available to you to help get the word out about your book so people actually see it and buy it. Get these videos for free at tomwoods.com/Kindle. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, talking to Dan McCarthy today. Dan is editor of Modern Age, which we'll talk about at the end of our conversation, very important journal dating back to the 1950s. He is the author of a recent article on Joe Biden that appeared in the American Conservative magazine. And I thought, you know, with all this craziness going on, Joe Biden is practically invisible. And yet, what does Joe Biden represent? What does this bundle of mediocrity represent? Dan's got a really interesting take on that, so I thought we would bring Joe Biden to the forefront for just a few moments in a conversation with Dan McCarthy. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. I'm delighted to be here.
I was just reading your article on Joe Biden, and I think it's not particularly original to point out that with this pandemic, he is just invisible. And I was wondering, what exactly do you do when you're running for political office? You can't hold rallies. You can't go to the coffee shop at breakfast time and shake hands. You can't shake hands. So instead, he's reduced to making videos, hosting an inane podcast, and releasing under his name the most banal, inane, platitude-filled tweets I have ever seen. It really is pathetic.
It is. And he's better served by invisibility than he is by popping his head up and making a fool out of himself.
That's true. So in a way, this kind of works to his advantage, I suppose, but he is really going to be continue to be invisible. And when you see the tweets, and it's just things like, if we work together, we can rebuild America, complete nothingness. It just reminds you of what a non-entity the guy is. I mean, really, you are reminded constantly of what a non-entity he is. And yet, the people who were going to pull the lever for him will say, I agree with you. Of course he's uninspiring, and he's the old guard, and he's everything we hate about the Democratic Party, but doggone it, we got to get Donald Trump out of there. I mean, we all know that's the appeal of Biden. That's the only appeal of Biden.
Well, that's certainly the Democrats' theory, and Joe Biden got lucky in the primaries in that it turned out that most Democrats were uncomfortable with Bernie Sanders, whether because they thought he went too far or because he was a little too sort of open and clear about what Democrats actually stand for. So, I think the vote for Biden in the primaries was not so much a positive vote for Biden as it was a negative vote against Sanders and a kind of gamble that, Biden is going to be the right kind of candidate for middle America and someone who might pose a threat to Donald Trump in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania, maybe even Florida.
I remember making fun of Biden some number of months ago when his campaign bus was revealed to the public, and it said on it in big letters, "No malarkey." And people made fun of him for this, including me, because first of all, it's just such a funny word of all possible things to say. But then I realized it became obvious that nobody under age 35 knows what the word malarkey means. They've never heard it before. And so I joked about it that there's nobody who even knows this language that he uses. But then I realized, maybe it's not cluelessness. Maybe, and now it's obvious to me, things like that, even just a turn of phrase like that, that are old-fashioned sounding, are his way of really connecting to his base, which frankly is the oldsters in the party. And so he's up against another oldster, but so he can use every even subliminal distinction he can get, that he's an old-timer just like you, and he uses old-timey language and the same kind of expressions you do. Am I reading too much into this?
No, although I do think there's a big difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Even though both candidates are in their 70s, President Trump is a few years younger, and President Trump represents a style of politics that's a big break from what we've seen over the last 30 years or so on everything from foreign policy to immigration to trade. whereas Joe Biden is the old guard personified. And he appeals, I think, to a certain nostalgic element within the baby boomers and within, in particular, what used to be called the white ethnics, you know, people like Irish-American voters, Italian-American voters, Polish-American voters. But, you know, these were people who, as baby boomers, they were youngsters or they were born, you know, shortly after JFK had been president and was assassinated. JFK was someone who loomed large for this generation as kind of the ideal of what a president should be, kind of a vapid ideal, but nonetheless, you know, something that they identified with. They found it kind of romantic and exciting. And, you know, JFK stood for this new frontier and supposedly an America that had a great promise and a bright future. And then, you know, about 30 years later, you get Bill Clinton is elected. He's the first baby boom president. And he seems to be the chance, the opportunity for the baby boomers now to see themselves in the president and to see, you know, one of their own generation rise to the kind of JFK legacy. And of course, what we saw with Bill Clinton was that he was JFK in all of the worst senses. He had the sex scandals and he had the, you know, sort of inept foreign policy that only led us into further conflicts. Well, now Joe Biden is the third iteration of that same sort of, you know, baby boomer, white ethnic ideal. And at this point, it's become kind of sad because it's, you know, it's talking about a guy who's in his upper 70s, who's going to be 80 years old if he gets elected president. And in his first term, he's going to turn 80. And it's just, you know, this generation will not let go and will not sort of clear the way for any kind of new way of addressing America's problems. Instead, it's just a constant reiteration of the same failed policies of generations.
You have in this article some analysis of this exact point where you say that we sometimes think of Trump as being a candidate of a certain demographic, but that we can't overlook Biden's association with a certain demographic as well. I think, though, we add to that, it's of course these older white folks, but obviously Biden has a lot of support from Black Americans. This was one of the things that hurt Bernie Sanders, who did better this time around than he did against Hillary with Black voters, but still a major swing to Joe Biden. And I'm curious about what, first of all, what you think motivates that. Because if I were a Black American, I just can't imagine saying, I'm really, really satisfied with the job the establishment has been doing, and I wouldn't want to shake things up at all. I want to keep things just on the path they've been on. I think I'd be willing to roll the dice. And so it's surprising to me that Sanders didn't do better. What do you think's going on there?
Well, you know, I was surprised too. I thought that Joe Biden's early lead among Black voters would erode over the course of the primaries, and that wasn't the case. And I put it down to two things. I mean, one of them is just the obvious. Yes, Joe Biden is closely associated with Barack Obama, the first African-American president, and that really did count for something with Black voters. The other thing is that partly building on that Obama connection, Joe Biden was very effective at going out and cultivating local African-American leaders, congressmen in places like South Carolina, who really had the ability to sway voters and who were sort of pillars of the community, at least politically speaking, and who, you know, commanded large numbers of voters. And Bernie Sanders apparently did an extraordinarily poor job of this. He did not go out there and try to, you know, cultivate people like Jim Clyburn. He was apparently just kind of neglectful of this. And that came back and that obviously destroyed basically Sanders's whole, you know, chance of becoming the nominee.
So now we've got Biden, and yet it seems that even though there are a lot of people unhappy with this and very disappointed that they don't get a chance to vote for Sanders, especially given that it looked like he was cruising to it, it looked like he couldn't lose until suddenly everybody ganged up on him. Elizabeth Warren stays in the race, pulls support away from him. I mean, who knows what went on behind the scenes there? Maybe nothing. Maybe it was just a pure coincidence and he just had the perfect storm thrown at him. It doesn't even really matter what the why of it is. That's what happened. And yet it seems like the Trump hatred is so severe, I can much more easily imagine libertarians refusing to vote Republican than I can progressives refusing to vote Democrat, particularly in 2020. I mean, again, do you think I'm wrong about this?
Well, but you know, that kind of being highly energized to oppose a candidate isn't necessarily enough to elect your guy. So think about how similar this is actually to Republican attitudes in 2012. Republicans were utterly, you know, finished with Barack Obama. Whatever goodwill they had towards him in 2008, they wanted to perhaps give him a little bit of a chance. By 2012, Republicans, you know, saw Obama in very much the same kind of light that Democrats now see Trump. Democrats, you know, are much more out of their minds with respect to Trump than Republicans were even with Obama. But you can see that there's a certain parallel there. And yet simply being anti-Obama was not nearly enough to elect a loser like Mitt Romney. And so when we look at what's going to happen here in 2020, I'm not sure that the backlash against Donald Trump and the mere Trump hatred that you see animating the Democrats is going to be enough to elect a guy like Joe Biden, who just has nothing positive to say for himself.
Give me the bird's eye overview. What are you telling people in your article, Joe Biden is the 2020 candidate of fear? That's an interesting way of putting it. Why fear?
Well, you know, I actually relate this to political philosophy, in particular, Thomas Hobbes. In Leviathan, Hobbes says that fear is the force that prompts people to enter the social contract in the first place. They don't want to live in the state of nature where things are nasty and poor and brutish and life is short. So basically, the negation of fear is the beginning of, you know, statism, of Leviathan. It's the beginning of a kind of welfare statism. It's the beginning of a certain corrupted form of liberalism as well. And Joe Biden is representative of that. He is a candidate who doesn't speak to people's hunger for dignity. He doesn't speak to their sort of pride. He doesn't speak to anything in them that is seeking greatness. And I think it's very significant that Donald Trump made greatness one of the themes of his campaign in 2016. Instead, Joe Biden is saying basically, hey, we can't take any risks here. You know, Donald Trump is he's trying to change too much. He's personally someone who's, approach to politics is a little too upsetting. We need to play it all safe again. And we just need to, sprinkle oil on these rough waters. And that seems to me to be a kind of psychological defeatism for his own supporters. Right. So even if Joe Biden were to win election, there's a sense in which, Biden's supporters are just giving up. They don't have an agenda. They don't have any hope. They don't have any real spiritedness to them. Instead, it's simply, we're afraid of the way things might be. And we just want to kind of have a gentle retirement and just enjoy, distracting pleasures and not have to really, live like daring human beings. And you see this, too, I think, even in, Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Hunter is, a kind of reprobate. He is someone who's known for having children out of wedlock with strippers and for having, sex scandals. And of course, known for being on the payroll of, a Ukrainian oil company that's connected to oligarchs. But all of that is kind of a life lived in a timid fashion where you just kind of seek creature comforts and you don't dare to do anything that's kind of courageous or that stands up for your dignity as a human being. Instead, it's just a kind of acceptance of, a kind of safe, cozy animal existence.
I've heard some Biden supporters speaking about the benefit of Biden being the people who will be around him. He'll have good people around him, which is also an admission of something. If they're saying he'll have good people around him, that says something about him that you're more interested in the people around him. And secondly, I think we've had, I think George W. Bush is an example of somebody who was dominated by people around him, and that was not a good thing because I didn't, not that I believe in these myths of democracy, but I certainly didn't vote for those people around him. And they certainly were, they seemed to be in charge. The thing that I think would distinguish Biden from Trump the most, or one of the things that would distinguish him if elected, and let's say there really is this terrible second wave of the virus later this year, I don't think Donald Trump would engage in the national lockdown they're all begging him to engage in. But I think the people around Biden would get him to do it. You think?
Oh, they absolutely would. I mean, you can see that Democrats right now are looking at this as a golden opportunity for a kind of, they were talking about a Green New Deal earlier. Now this is kind of a COVID New Deal or a Wuhan New Deal. This is a chance for all sorts of massive government spending programs, massive changes in the American economy, massive changes just in individual freedom. And it's insane. I mean, you've seen that even at Harvard University, certain academics have said, well, you know what, while we have everyone in this kind of socially isolating and so forth, they're actually homeschooling their children rather than sending them to public schools. And that's bad. We actually need to discourage that. We need to, you know, sort of really go after these homeschoolers and make sure that they don't gain a foothold as a result of people, you know, having their children at home during this disaster. I can totally imagine that, you know, if Joe Biden gets elected, the people around him are going to be these, you know, technocratic busybodies who are going to want to not only administer every part of the economy, they're also going to want to, you know, really get very close and up, you know, upfront with your churches, with your families, with your schools. There's going to be no sector of life that's not going to be penetrated by the government and micromanaged by these people.
Now, this is already happening to some degree on the state level, but at least there's the prospect that some states can have their own policies based on their own local conditions. I mean, we've seen, there are all kinds of points we could make here about hospital systems that are hemorrhaging money because they set aside all their resources for this alleged surge of cases that were supposed to manifest itself, and it never materialized. And so meanwhile, the revenue's not coming in. Meanwhile, other people who have other procedures, like in the UK, there's even some people saying that people with who need cancer treatments are not getting their cancer treatments, and you're going to wind up seeing more premature, avoidable deaths from that than you'll even see from the virus. So you can adjust this by local condition at the very least. If you believe this is a function of government, it can be done at the state level. And that's more or less what's been happening. Interestingly, by the way, the 10th Amendment has come up, hasn't it, with some governors asserting their powers under the 10th Amendment. And it's so interesting that the one time the 10th Amendment is allowed to be mentioned in polite society, it's not so that the states can hold off an overarching federal government that's reaching for too many powers. It's so that they can assert their own rights to engage in lockdowns and other sorts of powers and keeping the federal government out of stopping them from doing this. So it's a little bit, I think, I wouldn't say that's absolutely opposed to the 10th Amendment, but it's a little bit the opposite of what you would think the 10th Amendment would be used for in general.
Yeah, that's right. Instead of the 10th Amendment being a safeguard of liberty, you're seeing that certain opportunistic governors and others are using the 10th Amendment actually as a way to attack liberty. And that's kind of what you would expect from the kind of politicians that we have in this country, alas.
So I hate to do this to you, Dan, because it's just not fair. I was going to call you Joe. You are not Joe Biden.
I sure hope not.
No. Oh, by the way, on Twitter, I think it was the first or second episode of the Joe Biden podcast, whatever it's called, and his splash that he had, his little blurb that teases you, was supposed to tease you into listening, he says, I kid you not, Dan, this was how he promoted it. What do Fig Newtons and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches have in common? Well, tune into my podcast and find out. That Dan, no one in his right mind cares at all what he thinks those things have in common. Well, they're both food. Like, what are you talking about? Whoever that marketer is should be fired immediately. This is ridiculous. This is the most pathetic campaign of all time.
Well, but Tom, this really does speak to certain thing that I think is very widespread with progressives. They really do look at government as their parent, and they want Joe Biden to be, you know, he's their grandparent. He's admittedly a little too old to be their dad. So he's their granddad who's offering them raisins and a Werther's Original candy. Yeah. It's sad because, you know, they think this is kind of nice and, you know, avuncular and cozy. But really, it's saying that they're not adults. They can't take care of themselves. They can't, you know, feed themselves. They can't make their own decisions about their own health care. They need to have some sort of omnipotent authority and, you know, a benign sort of it doesn't have to be even an authority that's, you know, sort of seems commanding and energetic. I mean, someone as you know, as you've said, banal as Joe Biden, someone as checked out as he is still enough. I mean, it's just this really childish desire for any kind of authority figure who's reassuring and won't yell at you.
If I had to pin down what the message of the Trump campaign was, I could do it by identifying a few issues, like build the wall, and we got to crack down on China and re-examine trade agreements. and we probably have to review our foreign policy. Now, obviously, there are other issues, and if you asked him about anything under the sun, he would have an answer. But in terms of what he kept harping on to the point where you couldn't miss it, I would say it was primarily those three things. I can't name even one thing for Joe Biden.
I don't think anybody can. And, you know, that makes Joe Biden's pick of vice president particularly fraught with significant implications for the country, because the chances that Joe Biden will select someone who is more radical, more outspokenly so than he is as his running mate is, quite high. And given Joe Biden's age, I think it's more likely than not that even if he were to somehow win the White House, he would only be able to serve a single term, which means that whoever his running mate is very likely to be the Democrats' 2024 nominee. In effect, when Americans vote this November, the ones who are voting for Joe Biden are really voting for not just a president, they're voting for one president and then also a future president or at least a future nominee 4 years from now. I think that's going to be, the question is going to be whether Americans will buy, you know, this kind of harmless sort of packaging that you see with Joe Biden talking about Fig Newtons, or whether they're going to actually look under the cover and say, wait a minute, underneath this wrapper, you've actually got something much more radical here in the form of, you know, a running mate who is a dedicated, you know, sort of radical of one kind or another.
I'm going to say something that is going to shock people listening, but I hope they understand what I mean by it. I was not a fan of Mike Pence, and I didn't like that choice. And I'm not saying that he's a great guy now, but watching him talk about the virus and the federal response, I have to say, now leaving aside libertarianism and all that, he's very reassuring. He talks like a politician, but in the best sense, where he speaks very fluidly, without hesitation. He speaks with confidence. He gives you a sense of comfort, like there are rational people in charge. Now, I wouldn't have thought this would be the way Pence would make me feel at all, but I was very impressed with him. And so that might actually be a steadying contrast to a radical candidate, you know, in the debates who might be chosen as Biden's VP.
That's quite possible. And, Biden's going to go in for identity politics. He has pledged to nominate a woman as his running mate. And I don't know if Americans are going to go for that. It seems to me that they actually do want someone of substance, even if it's, you know, simply on the terms that you've expressed with Mike Pence. They don't necessarily want someone who is, simply checking a box on the latest diversity checklist.
Who do you think the possible names are?
Well, you know, it could be anyone from one of the candidates who ran in the 2020 primaries, whether that means Elizabeth Warren or Amy Klobuchar or Kamala Harris, all of whom have severe deficiencies of different kinds. With Elizabeth Warren, you know that she's a liar. You know that she is someone who's, quite hard on the left. In her own way. I mean, she's a weird sort of hybrid of corporatism and at the same time, certain kind of leftist class warfare as well. Kamala Harris as a prosecutor is someone who I think would really wield these amplified police powers that have grown up during the COVID crisis in a very, you know, frightening way. She would be whispering in Joe Biden's ear to continue crackdowns on any kind of, dissenters in the country. And Amy Klobuchar is probably the safest and most reassuring pick of those three. She's someone who is also a politically smart pick because I think she would probably do a lot of good for Biden's ticket in the industrial Midwest. But Klobuchar is someone who has, you know, a sort of fiery temper and is known for abusing her staff. And I think you could get a lot of ego, actually, with Amy Klobuchar. She was very upset. You know, you could see during several of the primary debates when other candidates had more cogent points. I forget whether it was Andrew Yang or someone else who kind of lightly made fun of her. No, I think it was actually Mayor Pete who lightly made fun of Klobuchar for the fact that she couldn't name the president of Mexico. And she got furious. I mean, you could see that, you know, the steam was coming out of her ears at that point. So she's a politician with a very sensitive ego and a very, willingness to wield throw a stapler around the room.
But wouldn't he want to try to generate some enthusiasm for his campaign by at least reaching out to the progressives in some way? Klobuchar or Harris is just a slap in the face to those people.
You would think so. On the other hand, you know, there just aren't that many progressives that you could imagine being, you know, Joe Biden's running mate. I think Warren is probably the most likely of, you know, that group, most likely progressive, that is. You know, it's certainly not going to be someone like AOC. And there's really nobody else among the Democratic progressives who has the kind of personal appeal that Bernie Sanders has. And of course, Elizabeth Warren herself doesn't have that, as we saw during the Democratic primaries, where a lot of her sort of upper middle class, highly educated supporters were furious that, you know, young socialists were not supporting Elizabeth Warren. They were supporting Bernie Sanders instead. So I think Biden's going to write off the progressive wing. I don't know that there's anyone he can put on his ticket who would satisfy the Sanders voters. He's just going to hope that they dislike, you know, Donald Trump much more than they care about who the Democratic nominee is.
Well, then does this portend some kind of political realignment? I mean, people have been talking about this for a long time, at least since Sam Francis in the 1990s. And for a while, I thought it was the Republican Party that was going to come apart because the old 80s model of strong national defense, family values, and the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people just rings hollow as a message to a lot of people today. And Trump just steamrolled over it. And people said, well, he's not talking like a conservative and nobody cared. But it looks like the Democrats have just as much problem holding their rickety coalition together. So do you think in 20 years we're going to look at American politics and it'll be different? Or is this Democrat-Republican divide just too resilient for any major change to it?
Well, I suspect you'll still have Democrats and Republicans in 20 years' time, but they may be very different parties than what they are now. And even if you don't have Democrats and Republicans, I think structurally speaking, a two-party system is likely to recur the way we have, you know, first past the post set up and other things. So I don't think people should get, you know, unduly worried about the party system itself, which has plenty of problems and is not a good thing, but at the same time is going to be so persistent that any reform is likely to cause, you know, more trouble than not. The Republicans did the right thing. They saw that their, you know, old ideological formulas were out of place, and they saw that actually, you know, I mean, there was a great case to be made for Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s. But in the 1990s and certainly in the 2000s, you saw that Reaganism got transformed. The actual Reagan elements were removed, especially the populist elements, especially the elements that were, you know, kind of on the right. And instead, you had neoconservatism and a new kind of technocracy implanted into it using the same rhetorical approach, but really, in fact, being a very substantially different thing. That's the difference between George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. It's the difference between Mitt Romney and Ronald Reagan. It's the difference between John McCain and Ronald Reagan. And this kind of Republicanism, the Bush and McCain and Romney Republicanism, it really had no future. And so it died. And the Republicans were smart enough to recognize that in 2016. And it turned to something radically different in the form of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, you know, he addressed these major concerns that, you know, voters on the right have been worried about going back to the end of the Cold War. Certainly our foreign policy being far too interventionist, far too utopian, far too much, you know, geared toward regime change, a basically de facto open borders policy towards immigration, and a trade policy which was really, you know, it wasn't pure free trade. What it actually was a trade policy designed to be as accommodating as possible to Beijing and to Wall Street. Well, Donald Trump came along and he said, you know what, the American people hate all of that stuff. I'm going to change it, or at least try to change it. And it turns out that that became a successful formula, not only for winning the Republican nomination in 2016, but then for becoming president. And of course, as president, now Donald Trump has had to face a federal government, an entrenched deep state bureaucracy that is working against him on all of those fronts. And so it's been a hard 4 years. And it's very easy for, you know, someone like Joe Biden to come along and say, well, you know, Donald Trump hasn't been able to accomplish all the things he promised. But of course, you know, what Biden is promising is simply that he is going to be in the deep state. He's going to go back to all those policies that Americans rejected 4 years ago. He's going to double down on them. And you're going to have, you know, an 80-year-old, you know, basically being manipulated by his vice president and by the people around him who are going to be the same kind of war harpies that you got in the Barack Obama administration. I mean, stop and think about that for a minute. Barack Obama He did actually oppose the Iraq war, unlike Joe Biden, who voted for the Iraq war when he was in the Senate. Barack Obama was not a guy who should have won a Nobel Peace Prize. He was not really a peace president. But he did, in fact, represent a bit of a scaling back of the warfare state relative to what it had been not only under George W. Bush, but under Bill Clinton as well. At least, Barack Obama tried a few things that seemed like they would be promising. But he surrounded himself with people like Hillary Clinton as a Secretary of State, and they buffaloed Obama into going ahead and doing things like the regime change in Libya and, conducting expansive drone warfare and failing to get us out of Afghanistan. Well, Joe Biden is much more interventionist than Barack Obama ever was. And so when you put those same sort of, Hillary Clinton types around Joe Biden and he's president, you're actually going to get a much more aggressive foreign policy than you got with Obama. You're going to get something that's going to be truly disastrous.
Now, let's shift gears before we wrap up. I would like it if you could take a couple minutes to talk about a periodical that I think a lot of listeners would enjoy and which has been around for quite some time, all the way back in the 1950s, which has featured a lot of interesting articles and authors over the years, including myself, I might add. And that is Modern Age, and I understand you're even having a promotion for it right now. So tell the folks about that, please.
Well, that's right. I'm very proud to be the editor of Modern Age, which is subtitled A Conservative Review. Modern Age is a quarterly journal that was founded back in 1957 by Russell Kirk, the author of The Conservative Mind and many other great seminal works of the post-war conservative movement. Russell Kirk was a traditionalist, but Modern Age has historically included some of the best works, not only of traditionalists, but also of libertarians, including a famous Murray Rothbard essay, The Fusionist as Libertarian Manque, which was, Rothbard's analysis of Frank Meyer and the idea of fusionism. And we've had, a panoply of wonderful authors over the years, including yourself, including, the wonderful Shakespeare scholar Paul Cantor. We have, It's really something I'm very proud to be associated with, given its history and given the fantastic work that I think my colleagues are doing and that hopefully I'm doing today. So I highly encourage, I think all listeners to this podcast would enjoy reading Modern Age. You can go to modernagejournal.com is the URL. And if you scroll down when you get to that homepage, you'll see there's an area where you can subscribe. And don't pay any attention to the subscription rates that you see at the bottom of the page right now. Just go ahead and click on subscribe. And when you get to the actual subscription page, you'll see you can get a year's subscription for just $18. So that's 4 issues in print, plus access to the digital edition as well. This is the kind of journal that you want to read in print because it's substantive. The articles are fairly long, but never at a tedious length. And so it's something you can really curl up with and read the way you would with a book, except that it's only going to take you an hour or two or an afternoon to get through. And you'll find it very stimulating. Intellectually, it's kind of some of the best conservative thought, best libertarian thought, best thought on the right in general that I think you're going to find pretty much anywhere.
So the website is modernagejournal.com?
That's correct.
All right. I'm going to have that link and a link to the article that we discussed today, Dan's article on Joe Biden. All this stuff will be at tomwoods.com/1637. Dan's one of my favorite people to talk to. He's doing great work at Modern Age. Modern Age holds a very exalted place in the history of conservatism and even libertarianism. So I think you will find it very much worth your while to check that out. So Dan, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks. Always a pleasure, Tom.
All right, folks. These days, the Federal Reserve is being portrayed as a savior once again. So more than ever, do you need my free ebook, Our Enemy, the Fed? So check that out at ourenemythefed.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.